Mark chapter 5. Mark chapter 5. We'll read verses 1 through 20. They came to the other side of the sea, to the country of the Gerasenes. And when Jesus had stepped out of the boat, immediately there met him out of the tombs a man with an unclean spirit. He lived among the tombs, and no one could bind him anymore, not even with a chain. For he had often been bound with shackles and chains, but he wrenched the chains apart and broke the shackles in pieces. No one had the strength to subdue him. Night and day, among the tombs and on the mountains, he was always crying out and cutting himself with stones. And when he saw Jesus from afar, he ran and fell down before him, and crying out with a loud voice, he said, "What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I adjure you by God, do not torment me." For he was saying to him, "Come out of the man, you unclean spirit." And Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" He replied, "My name is Legion, for we are many." And he begged him earnestly not to send them out of the country. Now, a great herd of pigs was feeding there on the hillside. And they begged him, saying, "Send us to the pigs, let us enter them." So he gave them permission, and the unclean spirits came out and entered the pigs, and the herd, numbering about 2,000, rushed down the steep bank into the sea and drowned in the sea. The herdsmen fled and told in the city and in the country. And people came to see what it was that had happened. And they came to Jesus and saw the demon-possessed man, the one who had had the legion, sitting there, clothed and in his right mind. And they were afraid. And those who had seen it described to them what had happened to the demon-possessed man and to the pigs. And they begged Jesus to depart from their region. As he was getting into the boat, the man who had been possessed with the demons begged him that he might be with him. And he did not permit him, but said to him, "Go home to your friends and tell them how much the Lord has done for you and how he has had mercy on you." And he went away and began to proclaim in the Decapolis how much Jesus had done for him. And everyone marveled. This is the word of the Lord. Pray with me one more time. Father, I stand here today against a great and powerful foe. I stand against a kingdom called darkness. Its craft and power are great. It's armed with cruel hate. And on earth, there's not an equal. But I stand today, I stand in the name and in the power of Jesus Christ. And beg you, O God, that you would not leave me, that you would not depart from me, but that today, through the word of Jesus Christ, through the preaching of his gospel, that the kingdom of God would be advanced. Holy Spirit, strengthen us for battle. I pray. Amen. I want to say from the very beginning that I've always hated ghost stories. I don't like the feeling of being scared or frightened, nor do I understand why anyone would willingly pay and go and watch anything like that. It's beyond me. You're not going to find me sitting around a campfire chanting, "We want a ghost story. We want a ghost story." I hate that feeling, and in me, that feeling is typically accompanied with anger, great anger. There's always been some type of fear in man when it comes to the spiritual world. For much of man's existence, human life has been in different ways affected by this fear. Many believed that the weather and health and fertility and their garden were all in the hands of these spirits. So much of their lives were an attempt to control these spirits. Today, we live in a day of science and know-how. Because of this, many deny even the existence of the spiritual world. We look back on bygone generations and shake our heads and laugh because, well, we know better. And yet, I must believe that the rejection must be due in some degree to the fear. Anything we can't observe, anything we can't explain, anything we can't have at least some semblance of control over scares us. It's like the well-meaning but misinformed parent who seeks to calm their children of their fears in the night by saying, "You shouldn't be afraid. Ghosts aren't real." We try to calm our fears with a lie. But I'm talking to you today. And though I'm sure we're more affected by the spirit of this age than we know or understand, I'm sure that most people in this room believe in spiritual beings. I'm sure of this because you can't be a Christian if you deny it. God is a spirit, infinite, eternal, and unchangeable in His being. But it can be difficult to find a healthy balance, even in the church. We either live as though they don't exist or we see them as the cause behind every bad thing. We either mock their existence or blame them for every piece of burnt bread that comes out of the toaster. Some shrug off any mention of devils or demons because they're afraid that people will use evil spirits as an excuse to evade responsibility. "The devil made me do it." While others do use the influence of evil spirits as an excuse to evade responsibility. "The devil made me do it." And yet today, in our Bibles, we come across one of the greatest, spookiest ghost stories of all time. And no matter where we are on this spectrum, we must deal with this story. Just a quick reading of this story can lead to many thoughts and many questions. The reality of the unclean spirits, for one. And then the question of demon possession. Does it still happen today? If so, what could we do about it? If so, how do we know and what does it look like? Exactly how many demons did this man have? How did he become to be possessed by these demons? Was it something that he did? And then you have questions about the pigs. Why did the demons want to go into the pigs anyway? Why did Jesus permit them into the pigs? Did the pigs commit suicide? What happened to the demons when the pigs died? I mean, can demons drown? Well, I don't have all those answers this morning. Though all these topics are interesting and the questions are intriguing, they're not the things that Mark's trying to communicate to the readers of this story. In fact, we must be careful because even though all these topics are biblical to some degree or another and addressed more or less at some points in the Bible, we spend our time with these things on our mind. I believe that we might be doing the very things that the demons would have us to do. They would love it if I spent the next few moments giving a lecture with the goal as proving their existence. They would love it if I spent the next few moments making a presentation to you, attempting to answer questions of whether demons still possess people today, and if so, what does it look like? Demons would love it if we got so offended and distracted by the destruction of the herd of pigs that it keeps us from seeing the glory revealed when a sinner is set free from hostile powers and reconciled to God through Jesus Christ. We will not play into their hands this morning. We know their ways, and they're not going to deceive us today. Instead, we will focus our eyes upon the Son of God, and we will see the main point of this passage is this. There is no case of animosity too great for Jesus to overcome. There is no force too hostile for Jesus Christ to subdue. He can do what no other man can do. And he is on a mission to do that very thing. In Jesus Christ, God is reconciling the world to himself. That is what is set before us today. Let's walk through the story together. Finally, in the quietness of the night, they arrived on the far side of the sea. They reached the beach of Gerasa. Here there is no crowd on the beach waiting for Jesus. There's no long line of sick people waiting to be healed. There are no Pharisees or scribes waiting to trip him up, to try to trap him in his words. Perhaps here, the reader might think, in the quietness of this night, at last he's going to find some rest. And then we read that immediately as Jesus steps off the boat, he is confronted by perhaps the scariest and most miserable creature in all of the Bible. Likely, they would have heard him coming from a distance because we're told that day and night, among the tombs, on the mountains, he was always crying out and cutting himself with stones. But all at once, this charge down the mountain culminated with him breaking through the darkness and falling at the feet of Jesus. He was naked. His body was covered with bloody wounds. He had broken shackles on his wrists and ankles. Three times in this description, Mark tells us that he lived among the tombs. First in verse 2, then in verse 3, and then again in verse 5. He lived among the tombs. There's probably a couple reasons for this emphasis. Mark wants to emphasize this man's estrangement from everyone else in the living world. He is in a condition completely cut off from life. Night and day, he is all alone living in a cemetery. But also, this man's habitation among the tombs would render him unclean. One touch from this man and the uncleanness would have been spread to them. But that wasn't the only threat. This is Gentile territory. They would have known this, but even if they didn't initially, it would have become quickly obvious, because we are about to read of a 2,000 herd pig farm nearby. The sound and the smell would have been undeniable. And according to the Old Testament law, pigs are unclean animals for Jewish people. This is an unclean land populated by unclean people who eat unclean food. But for just a moment, put yourself in the disciples' sandals. You would have already been put on the edge because of the great storm you just went through. Now you dock your boat in these conditions, but that's not the worst of the situation. Mark tells us that this sore-covered, naked man yelling in your face has a problem that's even deeper than his nationality. It's deeper than the neighborhood that he lives in. It's deeper than the food that he eats. He says this man has an unclean spirit. He's possessed by a demon. He has a body that's been taken over and now ruled by an evil ghost. And Mark's description of him depicts him as some supernatural villain that you'd expect to show up in the middle of a Marvel's movie. He's a terror to himself. He's a terror to others. His violence and his strength are hammered home. And three resounding negatives in the Greek. It says, not even by chains could anyone any longer restrain him. It seems that with time, his supernatural powers have only increased. From the reading, it seems like at one time they were able to restrain him, but not anymore. He had been bound with shackles and chains, but now he would just break them into pieces. At the end of verse 4, Mark summarizes what he had previously said. No one had the strength to subdue him. When Mark writes of the failed attempts to subdue this man, it sounds more like he's speaking of a ferocious animal than it does a human being. In fact, this idea of subduing him is the same thing James speaks of in James 3 when he says, we're able to subdue every animal except for the tongue. Well, he says, this man's not subduable either. So great was the power of evil in him. He was like an animal on the loose. This demon-possessed man is described in such horrible detail to show us clearly the hatred of evil spirits. They hated this man because he was a man. Human beings are made in the image of God. As they gained control of him, they did everything they could to destroy this image. His mind was deranged. He was self-destructive. He howled at the moon. He was separated from human society. He lived among the dead tombs. He was a wrecked person, physically and spiritually and mentally and emotionally. Mark describes this man as the epitome of uncleanness. Here is this demon-possessed man, is the very embodiment of alienation. This is a startling picture of human wretchedness and the resulting alienation. Perhaps the power of evil was more concentrated in this one man than in any other person in the world. This must have been the most unclean, alienated man in the world. This is the man Mark introduces us to in the story. This is the man who approached Jesus immediately when Jesus stepped off of the boat. And though it was night, somehow this man knew it was Jesus from a distance. Even before Jesus stepped off the boat, because Mark writes in verse 6, and when he saw Jesus from afar, he ran and fell down before him. Crying out with a loud voice, he said, what have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? We probably shouldn't make too much out of the man falling down before Jesus. It's likely more of an indication that the demons are in control of him and they recognize Jesus as a superior power who is a threat to them. In fact, as the conversation that follows seems to reveal more about known hostility than humble contrition. But the man cried out with a loud voice and said, what have you to do with me? In other places, this phrase is usually found in settings where there's some type of hostility going on, and it seems to signify the demon saying something like, what do we have to do with each other? Why are you interfering with me? Or even implying something along the lines of, why are you not minding your own business? And just like the other demons that we have encountered in the Gospel of Mark, so far in this Gospel, this demon knows precisely who Jesus is. Son, Jesus, Son of the Most High God. And they order him, command Jesus, do not torment me. Now, ironically, they are the ones torturing this man. Shameless to plead for mercy when they have shown none. Like a typical bully, They can dish it out, but they can't take it. And when Jesus asked the man his name, the evil spirit speaks and says, "My name is Legion, for we are many." This would be like a person saying, "My name is Green Berets," or "My name is 82nd Airborne." The Legion was a fighting force in the Roman army made up of about 6,000 soldiers. This isn't just one demon. This is thousands of demons. Evil ghosts inhabiting one man. It probably isn't being used to indicate that they were exactly 6,000 spirits in him, but simply to give us an indication of how utterly overwhelmed this man was by the extraordinary demonic possession over his life. Now, the demonic army begins to plead with Jesus like someone who knows that they're in the presence of someone vastly superior. They beg him, it says, "Do not torment me. Do not make us leave the region." They try to wheel and deal their way to a more favorable judgment. They plead, it says. It actually says they begged. They begged Jesus to reduce the sentence. There was we're told of a herd of 2,000 pigs on a hillside nearby. They begged Jesus to send them into the pigs. And it says, so Jesus permitted them to the pigs. We're told the unclean spirits came out of the man, entered the pigs, and possessed the pigs. 2,000 of them charged down the steep bank into the sea and drowned. The pig herders were suddenly unemployed. They had been responsible for the well-being of the pigs. They were obviously unhappy with some reason, I might suppose. They've watched their livelihood run down a hill and drown themselves in the sea. If they weren't the owners, I can imagine that this was going to be a tough sale to the owners. But they went and they reported the misfortune to everyone they could, both in the city and in the country. And so people came to see what was going on. When they got there, we read that they saw Jesus, and they saw this man who had been possessed by the Legion. He was sitting there with clothes on, in his right mind. And it says they were afraid. They continued to receive more eyewitness testimony. They heard what happened to the demon-possessed man. I mean, they could see what happened to the demon-possessed man. They heard what happened to the pigs. And what happens next is actually the greatest tragedy in the story. When they heard about the transformation of the man and the destruction of the pigs, they begged Jesus to leave. They began to beg him to depart from their region. They would prefer an army of evil spirits in their region rather than this man. John chapter 4 says, this is the judgment. Light has come into the world, and people loved darkness rather than light because their works are evil. For everyone who does wicked things hates the light and does not come to the light, lest his works be exposed. But whoever does what is true comes to the light so that it may be clearly seen that his works have been carried out in God. They begged Jesus to leave. They preferred the spirits to Jesus. The man interested them for a minute, but it was the pigs that got their attention. There's the demon-possessed man, clothed, calm, in his right mind. But look at our pigs. Look at our pigs. Their economic loss was more important to them than the deliverance of this man. And because of that, they turned their back on Jesus. Jesus was clearly challenging the worldly views of these people. He knew that the demon-possessed man was not the only person in this region under the influence of the kingdom of darkness. He was giving them an opportunity to see something better. Look, he was saying, the most valuable thing in the world is a person, is people. One person with thousands of demons is more valuable than thousands of pigs. There's nothing more wonderful for a person to be delivered from evil, to have his mind and emotions made whole again and turned to God. That's what I've come to do. I've come to save people, not pigs. I've come to make broken lives whole because I value people. This is the value system that I'm bringing into the world. People. But it was too much. While they could see how the kingdom of darkness had corrupted the alienated man, they couldn't see its influence in their own lives. The kingdom of darkness, you see, has one strategy, its deception. And every person outside of Jesus Christ, every person who does not believe in Jesus Christ is under this spell. It's why the Apostle Paul says that unbelievers are corrupt through deceitful desires. They're alienated and hostile in mind, doing evil deeds. It's like this is why they begged him to depart. And it's why, if you are here and you have not become a Christian, if you have not surrendered your life to Jesus Christ, this is why. This is the Bible's explanation. It's because you remain blinded by the kingdom of this world. You remain enslaved to sin of this world. But one day, the tables will turn. It will not be just you begging Jesus to depart from you. It will be Jesus commanding you to depart from him. Because he clearly says in that last day to those on his left, depart from me, you cursed, into the lake of eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels. No excuses will be valid. They tricked me will not work. Because all excuses are rooted in deception. I was too old. I had already lived a life of sin. These are words of the deceived. An excuse that's not valid. I'm too young. God will not hold me accountable or responsible. These are the words of deceived people. I never knew I was going to die so young. I thought I'd have more time later. These are words of deceived people. They're words of hostility, of enmity, of alienation. These are the hearts that beg Jesus to leave. And it goes on to say, as Jesus was getting back onto the boat, the man who had been possessed comes and begs to go with Jesus. Begs that he might be with him, it says. Because that is the desire of every new Christian. They want to be with Jesus. One of the markers you know that grace has broken in and set you free is you want to be with this Jesus. This is the only healthy response to mercy. This is a compelling climax to the story. It stands out in such a powerful way. Each, perhaps you've noticed, each of the three groups beg Jesus for something. The demons beg him to go into the pigs. The crowd begs Jesus to leave. And now the new disciple begs to be with Jesus. Yet only the man in his right mind begs for the right thing. The one who earlier was the epitome of alienation, the one who was the embodiment of hostility, now begs to be with Jesus. Because that is what a disciple is. He is sitting at Jesus' feet, like we saw in Mark chapter 3, when Jesus looked at those who sat around him and he said, "Here are my mother and my brothers. For whoever does the will of God is my brother and sister and mother." You see, this man wasn't just released from demon possession. The grace of God in Jesus Christ has overcome the alienation and has brought a full reconciliation. He is now among those called brother. He's now a part of the family. He's been given the secrets of the kingdom. The hostility has been silenced. The gap has been bridged. Enemies have become friends forever. Because in Christ, God is reconciling the world to Himself. See, this story is not in the Bible primarily to pique our interest in demons. It's here to show us something absolutely wonderful about Jesus Christ. He had been on the other side of the Sea of Galilee. There were huge crowds there. Everybody wanted to see him there. He was experiencing tremendous popularity there. And yet he told his disciples, "Let's go to the other side." Because he had a plan. So they set out across the lake, they ran into a storm, and they landed on the dark side of the lake. And now we see. Now we see why Jesus left the huge crowds and the popularity. Because there was one man on the other side. This trip was about this one man, this horrible man, a violent man with a broken mind, cut off from society of normal people, but a man valued by the Son of God. And here is the wonderful truth. People are valuable to Jesus. Broken people are valuable to Jesus. Enslaved people stir the compassion of His heart. There is no power strong enough, no hostility deep enough, and no alienation far enough to keep Jesus Christ from reconciling to those He came to save. There is no distance He will not go, whether it be across the Sea of Galilee or from heaven to earth. There's no obstacle He will not endure, whether it be a hurricane or the wrath of God. Brothers and sisters, if while we were enemies, we were reconciled to God by the death of His Son, how much more now that we are reconciled shall we be saved by His life? This is the mission. This is what He was all about. He left heaven and came to earth on this mission. He came to reconcile enemies. He came to reconcile God and man. And just a few chapters later, at the end of Mark, we will see Jesus in His final hours. We'll see how He was able to accomplish this great work. And what is so interesting is that in His sufferings, in His brokenness, we see this man from Gerasa. Jesus is stripped of his clothing. He's covered with wounds. He's driven out of the city, out of human society, to the place of the dead. Jesus groaned in agony. He was mocked by demons and men. He cried out, my God, why have you forsaken me? Jesus exchanges places with this man. He became like him in death in order to save him. And that is what it cost Jesus to save you and me. That is what it cost him to reconcile us to God. Cost him total brokenness. Material brokenness, social brokenness, emotional, spiritual. He suffered, and in his passion, he suffered the pains of the wrath of God. Because human beings are valuable to him. Because even when we were under the control of darkness, shouting defiance, he set his love upon you. He chose you. He had a plan for finding you and healing you so that in this life and in the life to come, you would be a whole person, sitting clothed in your right mind, being with him forever. Let that great saving work just sink into your heart. These are the great things that Jesus has done for you. This is the great mercy that he has shown to you. This work is the only one that can silence this rebellion. This is what draws our heart to him. This is how the desire to be with him is birthed. It's by standing in amazement at his mercy, by watching him become an alien so that you can become a son and a daughter. The man who had the legion, he says, begged Jesus that he might be with him. And in the story, this man is the only person in the story who begged Jesus for something, and Jesus doesn't give him what he asked for. Jesus sent the unclean spirits into the pigs. He was getting on the boat to leave the region, just as the people begged him to do. And now this man begs to be with him, and Jesus doesn't permit it. Instead, he says, go home to your friends. Go to your family and tell them how much the Lord has done for you. Tell them how he has had mercy on you. And so it says he did. He went and he proclaimed in the Decapolis, that's 10 cities, how much Jesus had done for him. And it said, everyone marveled. I ask you, as we hear that, go tell them what the Lord has done. Go tell them how much about the mercy. My question, are we willing for mercy to define us? Are we willing to tell who we were so that mercy can be seen for what it is? We're so tempted so often to hide our past, ashamed of what we've done, ashamed of who we are. We want to keep our past to ourselves. Better yet, we would like to forget it. But to keep our past to ourselves is to keep this mercy to ourselves. For us to come across to the other side, to others as being good people that Jesus saved, is an attempt to share in the glory. To be sinners that Jesus saved is to give Jesus the glory. Three times in this final paragraph, this man is referred back to as the man who had been possessed. He wasn't running from this. He owned that he was possessed by a devil once. And he glorified God that he had been delivered by Jesus Christ. And when the people heard the story, they marveled. Let me ask you, who were you? What would the writer of the story of your reconciliation call you? Were you the man who abused his wife and children? The man who stole from his family and friends? Were you the woman who had an abortion or the woman who was a prostitute? Were you the adulterer or the liar and manipulator? Who were you? Is your desire to forget the past causing you to rob your friends and your family of an opportunity to marvel? What awful condition did he rescue you from? Go and tell your friends, tell your family of the great things that the Lord has done for you and how much mercy he's had on you. Brothers and sisters, in this story, Jesus was on a mission. He was determined to overcome the greatest hostilities. He was on a mission to reveal his merciful power and to reconcile man to God. Today, the same message of reconciliation is offered to you. He has broken the strongholds that the evil forces once had over mankind. He's canceled the record of debt that stood against us with its legal demands. He set aside. He nailed it to the cross. He disarmed the rulers and authorities, and he put them to open shame by triumphing over them in him. The work of reconciliation has been done. All that now remains is the begging of the sinners to receive his mercy. Will you receive it? Will you run and fall at the feet of Jesus today? Will you come and bring him your animosity and trade it for his peace? He will make the trade with you if you will come. Will you receive this reconciliation? And if you will, then will you proclaim the mercy that you found? Will you make his mercy known to those around you? Will you be the ambassador on behalf of God, proclaiming this reconciling work of the cross and begging sinners to come and receive it? This is the mission of Jesus Christ in the world. Will you join him in that mission? You pray with me. Father, bless the preaching of Jesus Christ to the hearts of your people. I pray. Amen.